Although the space shuttle program has been suspended, space exploration still continues. The new Mars rover Curiosity was launched last month and is now making the 345 million mile journey to Mars, where it will sample soil and rocks in order for scientists to determine if life might once have been possible on the red planet. Michael Shara, a curator at the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History, has organized an exhibition called Beyond Planet Earth, The Future of Space Exploration, which offers a vision of what's to come in space travel in our solar system and beyond. It's on view at the museum through August 12th of next year, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Shara to our show today. Hello.
Hi, my pleasure to be here.
Why is it so important to determine whether life once existed on Mars?
Well, it's really symptomatic of whether there's life elsewhere in the universe. I think that one of the really key questions in all of science, not just astronomy, not just biology, is there life somewhere else? If we can find it on Mars, if we can characterize it on Mars, then we can answer such basic questions as, is it made of the same kind of DNA as us? Is it the same ACGT? Does it have different chirality? Mars is the easiest and best place to look.
Most conjectures are that if there is life beyond our solar system, it would be kind of slime, wouldn't it?
In most places, it probably is. Not very pleasant. You wouldn't be able to have much of an intelligent conversation with it, but you'd have a heck of a time studying it. You'd like to sequence it, see what it's made of and how it's evolved.
So if one of our space probes that we sent out many years ago with CDs in them and pictures and maps and all of that, landed in one of those planets, would the slime even understand what the heck they're seeing?
I don't think there'd be much of a conversation. And given that it's going to take tens of thousands of years to get to any of those planets and we're not directed at any of them, I just don't think that's very likely.
Will Mars be the next destination for humans, do you think?
I think not. I think the moon will be because it's much easier, much cheaper, and we will almost certainly go back there first. Though I would say that a near-Earth asteroid, an Earth-crossing asteroid, one of the things, frankly, that threatens us would also be a very logical place to go.
Well, we haven't been back to the moon since 1972. That's what, 30?
Almost 30 years. 40 years and counting. And what a pity. We learned so much
from it. Well, why haven't we? Is it just a matter of economics or
failure of
changed priorities?
Yes. The decision to do the International Space Station and the shuttle basically sucked up all of the manned mission money, $100+ billion spent on the International Space Station, the shuttle programs. And while they did some fabulous things, in particular repairing and upgrading the Hubble Space Telescope, perhaps the greatest thing that the shuttle did and the shuttle astronauts did, that's really where all the money's gone.
But even though you say Mars is not a real destination, in November, a crew emerged from a 520-day simulation of a mission to Mars. I'm assuming these mock voyages are an important part of planning for space travel.
Oh, certainly. And I firmly believe that we should go to Mars. I think it's a terrific idea. But
would it take a little under a year and a half, the 520 days to get there?
Oh, no. It's only about a nine and a half month trip to get there. It's less, but it's 9.5 months there, 9.5 months back. And, of course, you want to spend some time on the surface and exploring. So in aggregate, yes, probably a 500, 600, 700-day mission.
In the meantime, we have the Mars rovers. There are two there now, aren't there?
The Spirit and Opportunity are on the surface. Only one of them, unfortunately, is still alive. We lost one. But remember, it had a 90-day warranty, and 5 years and cranking, still producing science data is pretty terrific.
And what kind of information have they been providing?
I would say the key result from both of them has been that water used to exist in enormous quantities on Mars. It was flowing freely on the surface. It must also exist underground. A lot of the geological features that we see on the surface of Mars could only have been formed by water. And even more important or even more convincing, some of the rocks that you see on the surface can only have been formed in a liquid, watery environment.
So now we've sent this new rover. What is its goal?
It's going to be looking more directly for life in the sense that it's looking for, say, methane in the atmosphere. Methane is a waste gas produced by almost all living things. It's going to be looking for organics in the soil. It's also going to be sampling the weather, temperature, pressure, wind velocity on the surface, a kind of weather station for future astronauts.
And it's heading for a specific destination. Why
yes.
This place?
Right. This particular crater has a relatively safe landing spot. spot on Mars. We think we can put this very, very large rover, about the size of an automobile, down on the surface. But we also have a mountain next to it that we're going to climb up about 3 miles high and really look at all the strata. Many, many millions of years of geological history have been bared for us. Nature has done it for us. And so we can sample much of the geological history of Mars just by climbing up the side of this mountain.
And we can be that specific and actually aim this rover to this exact spot?
Sounds amazing, but the answer is yes. We're going to be able to put it down in something that's not much bigger than a football field. We know exactly where it's going.
And we've worked out that problem of confusing meters with inches?
Yes, NASA has learned a very bitter lesson from that and will not do it again.
Now, this just analyzes what it finds. Is there a way we can ever get physical samples back to Earth?
It's more challenging. I think the answer is absolutely yes. You'd probably do it in a 2- or 3-stage mission. That is, you would go to perhaps Phobos first, which the Russians tried to do and recently, unfortunately, just failed. You would also place a return rocket on Mars with the fuel ready to return, dig up some samples, and bring them back. So I think it's probably going to be robotic first.
My guest is Michael Schauer, curator in the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History, and the curator of Beyond Planet Earth, the Future of Space Exploration, which is on view at the museum through August 12th of next year. We also have the Juno probe that's currently heading to Jupiter. That won't touch down, will it?
No. This is not meant to be a lander or a sampler or a return mission. It really is to study this gas giant, the largest planet in our solar system.
In fact, if it went into Jupiter, it would just go right through because it's a gas giant.
Right. Well, it would be swallowed and crushed. As you go deeper and deeper in the atmosphere, the pressure rises and it would be gone.
Is it significant that the mission is named after the wife of the Roman god Jupiter?
It's not an accident. It was certainly thought of. Yes, sure.
And do we have any other rovers or probes on or heading for other planets?
Perhaps the most interesting right now is a probe that's headed for Pluto. We at the Natural History Museum, and in fact most astronomers, don't consider Pluto to be a bona fide, a major planet of the solar system. It doesn't dynamically control anything except the several bodies orbiting it, its own moons. But Pluto is a fascinating object, and the express mission, the high-speed mission heading towards it, which will not orbit or land, it's going to be going too fast to stop, will give us the first view of these outer solar system bodies.
And then it'll just keep on going?
That's correct.
And how far can it keep on sending signals back even if it goes into another solar system?
Well, probably not. If it were to reach another solar system, we're talking about light years away. And that, I think, is beyond the capability of the transmitters to live that long. That is the 50,000 years or so till you get there. And then even so, the signals, just watts or tens of watts, wouldn't make it back here.
Well, what happened with Pioneer 10 and 11, which were launched in 1971?
Still going, still chugging along. We're getting indications now from one of the probes in the outer solar system that it's entered the dead zone. We think that there is a flux of particles, protons, from the solar wind, from our sun, that's flowing outwards and crashing into the ambient interstellar medium, and there should be a standing shock zone between the two. There are some indications that we may just in the last few weeks or months have entered that with one of the most distant probes we've sent out.
And that would be something we would have to consider if we decided to ever send a ship beyond our solar system?
Well, it wouldn't be a danger. We would simply cross it. It would be like crossing a wake. You know, when a water skier is skiing behind a boat, there is that shock wave or that wake. You have to ski over it. It's not going to do any damage to spacecraft.
What do these probes look like? How big are they?
Oh, typically the size of your desk or maybe the size of a Volkswagen Beetle in the biggest case. A lot of them have huge antennas because they're designed to send signals back from way, way beyond the outer planets.
I mentioned those plaques that were on the Pioneer spacecrafts. Mm-hmm. Was that a matter of innocence in an earlier time?
I think it was partly innocence. I think it was partly a wonderful attention getter. It really called attention to the missions. Some of the science that was being done or trying to be accomplished on it has been forgotten by the public, but those plaques have stuck in the memory. And that, I think, is a really good thing.
You mentioned that the next destination probably will be the moon. Mm-hmm. But aren't most of the astronauts quitting the program now?
Many are retiring. They've been in the program for a decade, 2 decades. Some have had flights. Some, unfortunately, haven't. And they're saying, well, look, we're not going to have a major U.S. probe for the next 3, 4, 5 years. We're building a new rocket. We're building the Orion system to take people to orbit. Some of the astronauts are sticking with it, and I think NASA will bring on new people. And the desire, say, to go to an asteroid, to go further than the moon, go 3, 4, 5, 10 times further, is really strong within the astronaut corps.
Going to an asteroid, asteroids are big enough for us to land on them?
Well, you don't really land on an asteroid, you dock with an asteroid. It's like coming up on a very large space station. The ones we would go to would be a couple of 100 yards across, and we want to learn how to characterize them. How solid are they? Can we deflect them? If one is coming right at us, do we just sit there like suckers? Do we just take it on the jaw, or do we fight back?
Oh, we send Clint Eastwood or somebody up on with a rocket to disintegrate it.
Well, that's the Hollywood version of it, and there may be much smarter and much safer ways of doing it. You know, if you blow one of these things up and you still get hit by hundreds of pieces, it's like being shot by a shotgun shell rather than a single bullet. So you'd much rather deflect it than blow it up.
Can you describe the plan for a lunar elevator? How would that work?
The lunar elevator is something we have in the exhibition, and it's near and dear to my heart. What you have to imagine is putting a rock halfway between the Earth and the Moon. The Earth's gravity overwhelms the Moon's gravity, and so the rock wants to fall towards the Earth. If instead of a rock you put a space station, and you run a cable, a strong enough cable, from that space station back to the Moon, then the space station can't fall towards the Earth. The cable holds it in place. And what you have then is a cable stretching from the moon almost all the way back to the Earth. Put an elevator on that cable with some counter-rotating wheels, or better still, put a luxury cruise ship on that cable, and you have lunar tourism.
Well, we are talking about lunar tourism these days. Elon Musk, the founder of PayPal and Tesla Motors, and Richard Branson are two entrepreneurs who are funding ideas for space travel. Is it likely that they're going to succeed in my lifetime?
Oh, I think that they're going to succeed next year. I think you're going to see Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic starting to fly people either at the end of next year or certainly the year after that. Initially, $200,000 for a ticket to a suborbital ride, something like what Alan Shepard did. But within 3, 4, or 5 years, my guess is it'll be a half or a quarter of that. About the cost of a luxury trip around the world today. And many tens and then hundreds of thousands of people are going to start doing it very soon.
And how does Virgin Galactic work?
Virgin Galactic puts you in a space plane carried by a larger airplane up to about 15 miles, about twice the height of a commercial airplane. And then that big airplane drops your space plane. It's you, 4 other passengers, and a pilot. The pilot will point the plane vertically, fire up the rocket engines, and you will go up to 100 kilometers, 62 miles, about 4 or 5 times the speed of sound.
So it's almost like shooting a missile off of a plane.
That is correct. It's exactly like it. And that missile is built a little bit like a shuttlecock. It's designed to stabilize itself as it falls back into the atmosphere. You'll experience 5 or 6 minutes of weightlessness near the top. You'll see the stars come out in the middle of the day as the sky goes pitch black because you're above the atmosphere. It'll be a hell of a ride.
And then you'll then be parachuted back to Earth?
No, your space plane will actually come back, swoop and swerve to get rid of its excess velocity, land at a conventional landing field in New Mexico, and you'll step off just as you do off a 747 today.
And I imagine that would cost a couple of dollars.
Well, $200,000 initially is what Branson et al. Are requesting. And again, with competition, he's not the only one building this sort of thing. It's going to come way down.
What about SpaceX, Elon Musk's company? Is that similar?
They're not aiming at tourism. They're aiming for NASA contracts, in particular to supply the International Space Station. And I think it can't come too soon.
But because right now, in the past, the space race was fueled by competition in the Cold War. And for a long time, the United States dominated. But now it's pretty much a Russian and potentially Chinese venture, isn't it?
Right. And even more potentially, more than potentially, the Chinese have successfully had three launches. My guess is within 2, 3, 4 years, they will go to the moon. They will orbit the moon. So it's not just the U.S. anymore.
Is the space station actually doing anything, or is it just something that we had to prove we could do?
No, there are 6 astronauts on board the space station all the time. 3 of them are fully occupied with keeping the station running, but the other 3 are doing scientific experiments. There are mostly biological experiments on board. There are some physics experiments. So there certainly is an attempt to use it as a science station.
I know somebody went up there and said that she was stunned by just what a mess the whole place was, because there's a bunch of guys all living together. What do they do with their garbage?
They compactify it. You basically put it in a crusher and you scrunch it down to the smallest volume that you can. You can't just pitch it overboard, because then it becomes orbital debris, which can come back and bite you. If it comes back at high speed, it can punch a hole in your station.
On the other hand, we have a lot of orbital debris, don't we, up there anyway?
Many tens of thousands of pieces. Anything under about 300 miles falls out of orbit in years or decades just because of residual drag in the upper atmosphere. But there is a lot of junk up there.
Now, what about the Hubble telescope? It was designed to be continually updated while it was in orbit, and we've abandoned that idea.
No, the Hubble was refurbished by NASA astronauts using the shuttle, the last one just over a year ago. A fabulous refurbishment. The telescope is now working better, has more powerful instruments, and is producing data that is really better than anything that we've had since it was first launched 21 years ago. We expect to get about another 10 years out of it, certainly 8, unless some major component fails. And during that time, the James Webb Space Telescope, the next generation space telescope, which is going to have in many ways 100 times the capability of Hubble, we will complete the construction of it and the launch of it.
The Times reported the other day about these 2 huge black holes that have been discovered. Were they discovered through the Hubble or on Earth-based telescopes?
It's a combination of the two. You never really use just one kind of telescope anymore. You use multi-wavelength astronomy, giant X-ray telescopes to see these X-ray sources, Hubble to get spectra of the very, very cores of galaxies, large ground-based telescopes to follow up. And so the answer is all of the above.
Now, one of the things about living in the space station is that you're living for a long period of time in zero gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know what that does to the human body? Have the people who've come back recovered completely?
Most have. It's not a good idea. The longer you're up, the more calcium you tend to lose out of your bones, the more brittle your bones tend to become. Though John Grunsfeld, one of the chief NASA astronauts and one of the people who repaired Hubble, told me that there are now very interesting experiments underway to give astronauts more vitamin D and more sunshine to help try and prevent that from happening. The knowledge that we have today is that it's not a good thing. You really want at least some fraction of a gravity. 1/6 G, 1/10 G for at least part of a day would probably ameliorate some of this, though diet and exercise may help too.
Well, how can Hubble be prepared now that there are no longer space shuttle missions?
Hubble itself probably can't. Unless we develop the capability to dock with it, rendezvous with it, and upgrade it, and perhaps with a robotic mission, we might be able to do some of the simpler tasks robotically. We will probably lose Hubble in 7 or 8 years.
Isn't Europa, one of Jupiter's moons, the place that people think is most likely to have life in our solar system?
Yes, for sure. There's
Why Europa?
Well, there's a
pretty far away from the sun, isn't it?
It is, 5 times further away than the Earth. There's a giant salty ocean covered by ice. It is stressed. It's tidally stressed by Jupiter, which keeps the core hot, which means volcanoes and black smokers at the bottom of the ocean. And just as at the bottom of the Atlantic and Pacific, where you have these black smokers throwing organics and sulfides into the water and heat, you have entire ecosystems springing up of living organisms. That's the kind of thing we would love to look for in Europa, and we show you doing exactly that in Beyond Planet Earth.
Because you have a replica of a robotic submersible device that would go down into that ocean?
Precisely. And if we could do just that, if we could melt through the ice or drill through the ice, and there are very clever plans for doing just that, put the submersible into the ocean, that would be, in my guesstimation, the second most likely place after Mars where we're going to find some kind of life.
Well, it would be some kind of life. It probably would be one cell or a couple of cell life.
Who knows?
The sort of thing that we find in the bottom of our oceans.
Well, no. We see things as large as crabs down at the bottom of our oceans. There's big stuff living down there.
I want to thank you so much for being on our show today. Michael Schara, curator in the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History. The exhibit Beyond Planet Earth, The Future of Space Exploration is at the museum through August 12th.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And then what happens to it?
We have several people who are interested in taking it. We know that it's going to go on to Matatek in Haifa, Israel, the end of next year, and several other museums looking at it also.
And how likely is it that the things that you have in this exhibit are actually going to come to fruition? How much of this is just hypothetical stuff?
I think all of it is going to happen. The most far out is going to the exoplanets. We have the largest hologram ever built, which displays more than 1,000 of the Kepler exoplanets. That's centuries away, and I have no idea how we're going to get there. But everything else in the exhibition is within our technological capabilities if we have the nerve and the focus.
Thanks again.
My pleasure.